Okay, let me begin actually with a conscious issue. We spoke two times ago. Remember the issue of Vishalakum and sushi. I raised it. I don't need to go through the whole thing as to how I came to it through Rabbi Tendler, but I said that if you look around today, it's clear that people are eating raw fish. So should that change the halacha? So I looked into it after the class. I think you'll find really interesting what I share with you. And I think Chaim, I see Chaim is with us, for also sending me some sources for this. So again, the issue is a food that's what's called Ola al Shulchan Malachim, that you could serve, like at a state dinner, important dinner. It has to be cooked by a Jew. For Ashkenazim, as long as the Jew is involved in, let's say, turning on the stove, he doesn't actually have to be involved in the whole cooking. That's enough. But that if we also know that if it's can be eaten raw, it doesn't matter. There's no such concept of bishalakum can be eaten raw. Food that you would eat raw or cooked. So today the issue is what about fish? Because of sushi. And would it apply to all fish or just the specific fish that are eating that are eaten raw? So I looked around a bit. The first thing I found, actually, Rabbi Dov Linzer. He says that if what was cooked was fresh enough to be eaten raw, that is sushi grade, he thinks it is probably excluded from Bishalakum. I don't know if that's halacha l'maisa because he says it's probably excluded. But I don't know from him, does this mean all fish? But okay, certainly for tuna, something like that. But the fact is, if you look around online, you find that that's not the mainstream psak I see. So why isn't it the mainstream psak? It would seem to make sense. So that's where it gets interesting. First, I have to say, I think it was Chaim who mentioned that by tuna, the Vod, I think it was the Five Towns, maybe you said, they mention, they distinguish whether it was Bishalakumer or not. That's referring to canned tuna. We're not referring to canned tuna. I'm referring to regular tuna. So the first thing I saw when I looked around and was, oh, hold on, let me share my screen here with you, is I found an article. Oops, no, where is it? Here, the Daf HaKashrus from 2014 on this very question, sushi and bishalakum. And who speaks on it? None other than Hershel Schechter, because he's the posek of the OU, also Roy Belsky. And Rav Schechter has a chiddush, although Rav Belsky agrees with it, that I don't see anyone else say. And you'll see that he didn't used to have this. He thinks, and he has it's summarized in English, and also he has a Hebrew tshuva, that, and I don't know if, look, I don't eat sushi, so I can't tell you. I don't know how many of you are going to find this convincing, not just the halachic logic, but even the facts. He says, for instance, sushi is different. It's not like sashimi. Sashimi is raw fish, but very few people apparently don't eat that. But sushi, lots of people eat. But he says that the intention is not to eat the fish. Rather, the intention is to eat all the components together. And the other components are the majority. And some sushis don't even have fish. Fish is an important ingredient, but it's not the most important. And therefore, he thinks it's tafel, and you make a bracha mazonos. Now, I don't know. Is that true? Is sushi, forgetting tuna sushi, is the sushi really tafel? Is it secondary? That's what he says. He says that you only eat it together with rice or other vegetables. So that's the first chiddush. But then he says that therefore it doesn't. You do not regard it as raw fish. As if you'd eat it by itself, and therefore Bishalakum still applies because it's secondary. So that's interesting. And okay, no one else says that. In all the other sources I'll give you now, that the fact that it's eaten together with something else, and I can't find the sources that say this, mean that it's you don't regard it as really raw fish because you're only eating it together with something else, so it's separate. But Ray Belsky agrees with him. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Schechter apparently did not hold like this years ago, because thank you, Jacob, for sending me an unpublished responsum from the OU years ago from Rav Schechter. Very interesting, where he asks about this very question, And he raises some interesting issues. First of all, he says that Minhagim could be different. He says you have a Minhag in New York, that's one thing, but Minhag in Scranton is something else. So Jacob thought that this was addressed to me because it mentioned Scranton, but it wasn't addressed to me. If you recall from many moons ago, Rav Schechter explains in the letter published in my sefer, Igros Malchei Rabbanan, that he's from Scranton. He's born there. So when he speaks about Middle America, he doesn't say Peoria, he says Scranton. So when he just wants to say like some town outside a big city uses Scranton. So he raises the question, what do you do if the food is eaten raw in one place, let's say New York? But he says, he assumes here that people are not eating sushi in small town America. Again, I don't know if that's true or not, but therefore, so he raises a question. Let's say in New York, they are eating sushi. If it's made in New York, let's say the fish is cooked in New York and it's eaten in New York, okay, you could say it's mutter. But let's say it's cooked in New York, but it's eaten in Scranton. And people don't generally eat raw fish in Scranton. So he gets into all this discussions of this. But he says, Nira lo marshim abishul v'achdilo shnehem in New York, tishari. He says that it would seem that in this tshuva, he's saying that if it was, that it would be acceptable. He says, and he doesn't seem to take into account the fact that you're eating it together with, he says, sushi is eaten with hirakot, but he says it doesn't seem to distinguish it then. He said, in this earlier tshuva, or maybe it's a later tshuva, I don't know. He seems to be, he says it would be permissible when the fact that you're eating it together wouldn't, matter. So that there's a contradiction there. He says that the fact that you eat it together with the rakos, he says that that does not take away from the heter. So I don't know what Rav Schechter's current position is. If you look in other kashrus things, the CRC, for instance, they say as well that sushi is eaten with rice and seaweed. The sushi merely adds zing or tang to the cooked food. We don't eat sushi for the fish. And therefore, they say it wouldn't change. However, there's a kashrus organization called the MK, Montreal Kashrus. So I didn't know much about it. I looked it up, and lo and behold, what does it say? It says that it's the first kosher agency in North America. Now, I heard of them, first kosher agency in North America. I could not believe it. How could it be the first agency? But lo and behold, it is. You look here on Wikipedia, MK Kosher is founded in 1922. The OU was founded in 1923. So there you go.
Mark, it's because
That was
Americans.
news to me.
Mark, I'm sorry. It's because Americans know nothing about Canada. Sorry for that,
Exactly.
Mark.
I was shocked. I could not believe that MK Kosher is before the OU, but it is. And if you look, they have a whole piece on this, and they say tastes and customs change. And they talk about sushi. And they say, listen to this. Clearly, the avid consumption of raw fish is no longer limited to faraway islands. And the eating of raw fish may become sufficiently commonplace in Western countries for halacha to consider fish exempt from bishulakim concerns. So the MK assumes that as soon as enough people are eating sushi, then there is no bishulakim. And they say nothing about the fact it's mixed together. That for them is irrelevant. And also, the askhalacha.com website says, quote, if one is in a city where sushi is not eaten and most people there would not eat sushi, the fish in that city could not be considered eaten raw. On the other hand, if you're in a place where they do eat it, again, this website, I don't know who's in charge of this website, they assume that it is an issue. It's not an issue. So it's a machlokas. We'll have to see how this develops. And as I was looking in the Hebrew sources about this, I found some interesting things. Potatoes. We eat potatoes on Pesach. There was issues, should potatoes be kitnios or not? But the Aruch HaShulchan, he deals with potatoes. And it's amazing. He says, potatoes are not ole al Shulchan Malachim. He says, the Chacham HaSadam, the Chai Adam, who, by the way, wanted to make them kitnios. He says, the Chai Adam says they are fit for a king. He says that in today's day and age, he says, no, it's a poor man's food. No one would eat it. But the fact is that today you'd have to say that the Aruch HaShulchan's wrong, or his position doesn't apply anymore. Because I would say, contradict me if you wish, but you could be at the president's dinner and they'll serve potatoes. They'll serve all sorts of potato dishes are served. So I think French fries are not olal shochah malachim, as far as I know. That would not be your shalakum, but I think a regular potato dish would be. And then I was looking around, I found the Radbaz, who originally I said he was the last of the Rishonim, so maybe he's the first of the Achronim, or he's somewhere in the middle. He says something which is interesting also. I mean, you have all these issues with, well, he says that a chola she'ein bo sakana. This is in volume 4 of his Tshuvos, number 1000. He says that a chola she'ein bo sakana. I think it's 1000 or 100. I forget what I wrote here. There's no bishalakum. And that to me is a worthwhile psak to know about, because you have, for an example, in Israel, you have many older people. And you have these people come, Filipinos and others, who take care of them. So some people, they make a big deal. Bishalakum, they can't cook. The fact is that the Radbaz, an old person, is the status of a cholish ein bo sakana. And it shouldn't be an issue at all. Not to mention the fact there's this shita that if it's a hired employee, it doesn't apply. But I had this issue, I had an au pair who wasn't Jewish. And so what to do to make food for the children? So there was one of the local rabbis at one of these learning groups for the women, I guess, during the week. And a lot of the people had like these non-Jewish helpers said that they can't cook in the house. So remember, there was my wife ended up telling me this because there was a big outcry. What are we supposed to do now? We're not allowed to. Well, I don't know. I never thought that that was the issue, the psak. In fact, I spoke to a posek and he told me specifically. I asked him this question. I have a non-Jewish. And he said for a child, this person can cook the food. An old, an old person has a status of chol hashem bo sakana. I would think a child has a status of a cholish ein bo sakana, but this posek, his reason was the position of the raivad, not their famous raivad, the other raivad, that an employee, there's no bishalakum with a paid employee. That's we don't generally accept it, but in a situation like you're in the child's home, he thought that that was okay. So, but the Radbaz is in an interesting position. Last class. I think it was, I just wanted to remind you of this. Oh, here, this idea of praising yourself and, can you praise yourself at all? The Gemara already, permits a little here. In the Nedarim, it says, what is it? 62a. Rava says, it says in a time of need, it is permitted for a person to make himself known where people don't know him. So the Gemara already says you can explain who you are. You can so people know you're something. You have to toot your own horn. I mean, otherwise you'll never get a job. You'll never get anything. But I was talking about the more extreme, like I don't need to get into the details. You've all seen the websites and other things that they describe. People describe themselves in the most highfalutin terms. But there is a tradition even to do that, and they pun on this pasuk. The pasuk literally is against this. It says in Proverbs chapter 27, Ya'alel chazar, another person should praise you, v'lo picha, but not you, v'lo picha, not you. But they read it this way, Ya'alel chazar, someone else should praise you, v'lo. But if not, picha, then you do it yourself. And believe it or not, I just saw it today on Wikipedia in Hebrew, you have a whole article on this. The Zohar quotes this, and it's there's a whole shittas about this. Okay. Oh, you know what? I'll save the other thing I want to show you till next time about weddings. Interesting stuff about weddings that we spoke about. But I'll put this aside here because it's already 8:45. So let's pick up where we are. All my sorry here. I want to thank Rabbi Dov. Lokesh, yes, to get his website up with that. He has beautiful, beautiful articles on many different Rabbanim, Gedolim, and he sent me a couple, one from Rav Rudenberg, another, but and it has a story about the altar. We spoke a lot about the altar, so let me tell you, we mentioned also the son of the altar, Ramosha Finkel, he would have taken over the yeshiva in Hebron had he lived. The son-in-law, Rabbi Sher, we'll speak of Rabbi Sher today in a bit. He took over the yeshiva in Sobotka after the machlokes with the Yerushalmi was completed. And Rav Moshe Finkel, though he died in 19, 25, Chol Hamoed Sukkot of 1926. And the story is, that's reported by an eyewitness, is that when he passed away, only 47, the altar did not let a tear fall from his eyes throughout the holiday. He, throughout the holiday, and the students were crying, and even Simchas Torah, the altar danced. But as soon as the holiday was over, then, of course, he burst into tears. And we have other similar stories. In fact, Rabbi Lokitch quotes a story like that about the Nitziv, and similar stories like that. What I want to say, in fact, apparently with the Rav, there's a similar story like that with his brother, I think he found. But I want to say something here because I don't want people to get the wrong impression that we're dealing with individuals here who are like, Dr. Spock on Star Trek or something, people without any emotions. On the contrary, we do have Rabbanim Gedolim who have this Dr. Spock characteristic. The most famous is Rav Elvel of Brisk. For him, halacha determined everything. He had a child who died before 30 days, and his wife was crying, and he told his wife, this is mentioned in Uvnos von Hugos Brisk, to stop crying because there's no avelos. If there's no avelos, then there's no crime. I mean, that's, but, and we have some of these sorts of stories, of course, in each halachic man. The story of the Baal Tokeya, the Chabadnik. I mean, we have these types of stories, but this is exception. This is unusual. And that's not the case of the altar here. It's, he was able to control his emotion, but it's not that he didn't have emotion. And it was obviously very hard for him. That's, I think you have to understand this story. And I want to give you an example of this from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, which I think is an amazing story, although it could be that the yeshiva world tried to alter its original meaning, or maybe I'm wrong. And it deals with an issue that we all perhaps are focused on, Pidyon Shvuyim. In fact, on Pesach, I'm going to be speaking about Pidyon Shvuyim a bit because I'm giving a talk on Rav Shlomo Goren. And Rav Goren held that, what is Pidyon Shvuyim? The Mishnah tells you when, if someone, let's say, is kidnapped, you cannot ransom this person for more than the person's worth, however you determine that. And there's actually two explanations given there. The one explanation is because this would put too much of a stress on the community. And the other explanation is because it would encourage more kidnapping. The practical nafkamina is that if I'm Elon Musk, if they kidnap my son and they ask for $5 billion, well, I can pay for it. If the reason is not to put the any thing burden on the community, but if the reason is to encourage more kidnappings, then I wouldn't even be allowed to ransom my own son. And the halacha, as paskened in the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, is like the second one. It's not to encourage more kidnappings. But I can tell you that not only did people who had wealth ransom their children for more than they were, quote, worth, Klal Yisrael never accepted this halacha. The Jewish people have always ransomed for more than people are worth. They did it continuously. We continue to do it. For dead bodies, we release terrorists. So whether it's smart or not, you can debate. But Sinwar was himself was released in the Gilad Shalit deal. But it's amazing that here's a halacha. Our lawyers will call it black letter law. It's in the Rambam, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, where you can't. And by the way, we're not talking about the machlokes here over can a parent do it or not? Does the machlokes, by the way, can the husband release his wife for more than she's worth? Some say yes, because she, just like you can release yourself, you can release your wife, ishto kegufo. But others actually say, no, you can't. But I can't imagine anyone followed that. But we know historically that Jewish communities always broke this halacha and they paid more than according to halacha they were supposed to. So what's going on here? I recently, Rabbi in Israel, Neria Gutel, big scholar, Talmud Chacham, and he came out with a book about halacha in the state, and he deals with this matter. So I wrote to him. I don't really know him personally. I know him through correspondence. And what he said to me was as follows. He said that B'nai Kol Yisrael, Jews, are Rachmanim. We're merciful people, and therefore we could not accept this halacha. So here you have, and it's not like a conservative rabbi saying it, it's not me saying it, it's a big Rav and halachic writer and everything saying that this is one of those examples where the Jew, even though the halacha is clear, the Jewish people could not accept the halacha. In the past, we've spoken about examples where we don't accept the halacha for whatever reason. I mentioned the Rogatchover. Halacha is you can't learn when you're an Aval. When he said, I can't accept it. If you want to punish me, the Torah is worth it. It's worth being punished for it. So why do I mention this? Because Rav Gorin, by the way, holds that when it comes to Israeli soldiers, these rules don't apply. Because we send the soldiers into war, and they have to know for their morale that we will do everything we can to bring them back. And it might be bad to do a deal, and you might not want to do a deal that's lopsided, but according to Halacha, there's no issue whatsoever. And you could say that all Israelis are soldiers, but there's other poskim who say that these issues anyway, Pidyon Shvuyim, don't apply to the state of Israel. They apply in an era when they kidnap people for ransoms, for money. It doesn't apply to a country when the considerations are very different. Okay, so why do I mention this? Because the story is told as follows. Rav Yerucham Lavavitz tells the following story. Rav Yerucham Lavavitz, a student of the Alter and also of Rav Simcha Zisov Kalam, he's known as the Mashkiach of Nir. Very important Musar personality. And he published a book, or it was posthumously, a book was published in 1939, right before the war in Vilna, of his collected, it's called Chever, I think it's Mamarim, something strange, first word. And in that book, I just printed out the page, but I don't have the title here, page 219, he tells us as follows. He says that this is the story he heard about Rav Yisrael Salanter. So it is two generations away from it, that Rav Yisrael Salanter was learning Gittin, the Sugya, Ein Podin al Shluyim. You're not Poda, you don't redeem a captive for more than their worth because of Tikkun Olam, because it would lead to chaos, as I mentioned. And he started crying. So this is how I always understood the story. And it shows you the emotion. You know, it's an amazing sugya, Pinyon Shvuyim. We can have all sorts of shiurim. It's fascinating. There's lumdis. There's historical elements. You speak of Mayor of Rothenburg. He refused to allow himself to be redeemed. I mean, it's a fascinating sugya. And yet we look at it like this impartially objective way. Yisrael doesn't look at it this way. This is the halacha. You can't redeem them. But this means then that they remain captive. And they remain as hostages. Rav Yisrael learns this, and he starts crying, because that's what he thinks of. We don't have people like that. I mean, so I found that unbelievable, that he's crying, because he's not just looking at the lumdus. He's looking at the fact that someone can't be released, even because the halacha says so. It's a terrible thing. They can't be released, but what can you do? That's the halacha. So that's how I understood the story, but I did a search today on Otzer Chachma. They reprinted Yerucham's drashos, sichos, and new sichos, and the same story is repeated, but there's an addition to it. And I'm wondering if this addition is correct, or if this is just the person who recorded it, his interpretation of it. According to this, why did Rav Yisrael cry? He cried because. He's crying about the Mesiras Nefesh of the father who, let's say, who can't redeem his child. And that's sad. Okay, so look, that's something to cry about also. But in this version, he's crying because of the tragedy of someone who, because of halacha, can't redeem the child. And so it's sad. It's like you might cry. You can think of all sorts of examples. However, the way I saw it was, no, the crying wasn't because the tragedy of someone who wants to redeem and can't redeem. If you look at the initial version, they don't say that. And I just assume the tragedy is that the person still has to remain a hostage. So either way you look at it, you see, though, the emotion there, that we're not dealing with any spock here. Okay, we are now back to Sabbatka. Take all my papers here. We're in Sabbatka. And as I was explaining, the altar of Sabbatka, we began speaking about, and I looked up incidentally as to why he's called the altar. I was asked that. He mentions it in 12 Cats in volume 3. Volume 3 of Tenuas HaMusar is devoted to the altar. On page 209, he says he was actually given this title when he was a young man. Not an old man, the altar. And his name was, they called him Mashkiach. And after a while, they assume, they realize that this title Mashgiach doesn't really encompass everything he does, and they started calling him the Altar, or the Saba in Hebrew. And but they did that, we don't know why really. And he was, it's not like I said, I guess they saw him as a grandfatherly figure, because already as a young man they were calling him this. So we know that the Altar attempted and succeeded in many cases to profoundly shape the personality of the students. All aspects of their life came under his watchful eye. He would have deep and close conversations with them, trying to get to the bottom of their souls. He used all sorts of educational tools, the sorts of things that, if you're not into this, are going to turn you off and lead to the rebellion we'll see in a few minutes. Under the conditions of Sobotka, where they're watching you this way and trying to get into your life, and the Altar of Sobotka wanted to put a spy in Rabbi Chiya Weinberg's room. He thought he was going into Haskalah, all these sorts of things. It was much more difficult for students to become adherents of Haskalah or Chibat Zion than in place like Volozhin, where despite some attempts at supervision, for the most part, the students were not very closely monitored. Another important difference between Sobotka and, of course, later almost yeshivas, and Volozhin is that in a place like Volozhin, there was no focus on the form of self-introspection that we've spoken about, designed to improve your character, increase your fear of heaven. It was thought that the important thing to do in yeshiva is to learn Gemara, and done properly, that will lead to the fear of heaven and everything you need. What does it say? If you fear of sin, drag your Yetzirah to the Beis Medrash. Anything else was used as a distraction. So yes, on a weekend, if you want to open up a Mesillas Yesharim, it's a nice thing, but you don't break Seder for that, for a yeshiva bachur learning. And incidentally, why you? I asked my son. They have Musar, like in the week, in the evening, you'll have a Musar Shmooz. The Rebbe maybe once a week will say some Musar. The Mashgichim will come into the Beis Medrash, but there is not anything in the Beis Medrash that sets Seder, where every night, let's say 8 to 8:30, you put away the Gemara and you all learn Musar together. That's what they did in Musar Yeshivas. They don't do that in YU. And in a place like Volozhin, character improvement, fear of heaven, obviously these are important, but they do not merit special concern. Let's put it this way. Yeah. Now, as we mentioned last class, Volozhin is closed down. And many of these students from Volozhin, they end up in Slobodka. The conflict we're going to see right now is really the Altar's fault. He brought this into his yeshiva because he had a weakness. His weakness was for Lamdanim. He loved more than anything else a young man who was an Eloi, who was a great Torah scholar. And he didn't really care anything else. He's an Eloi, that's it. And therefore, he didn't weed out the people who would not be amenable to the Musar approach. So that's going to create the problems. The Volozhin Yeshiva, as we know, is closed by the Tsar's government in 1892. Ostensibly, the reason is because they won't institute secular studies there, but we know now that that was just a cover, that the real reason is because there was all sorts of chaos, I guess you could say, in the yeshiva over Rav Chaim in Berlin, and they thought that the government thought there was a revolution growing there, and therefore they shut it down. It was always a question. There's a lot of yeshivas in the Russian Empire. They don't require secular studies at the other yeshiva. Why all of a sudden Volozhin? So we know it was more complicated than that. So now you have all these students who want to go to a yeshiva. Furthermore, the Slobodka yeshiva developed a reputation as one that had funds. They gave good stipends for the students. So all sorts of people now want to go to the Slobodka Yeshiva, and they're not interested in Musar. And that's going to be the problem. Now, the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed down. And the Rosh Yeshiva, went their special separate ways. The Netziv would die the next year. Rav Chaim would become Rav in Brisk. The Yeshiva would reopen a few years later. But it didn't have its leading lights. It didn't have Rav Chaim and the Netziv. And therefore, the gifted students didn't return there. They went other places. If you went to Slobodka, you could study under two of the great Rabbanim Gedolim, brothers-in-law, Rav Yisr Zalman Meltzer and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. And if you're part of the yeshiva world, you know that their last names are never even used. You just say Rav Yisr Zalman. There's only one Rav Yisr Zalman and Rav Moshe Mordechai. Evanezo actually should be, and the Levush Mordechai. So these were great Rosh Yeshiva. Now we, and as I said, the Alter accepted students who had no desire to be part of the Musar environment because they just wanted to learn, because he loved Torah students. And you had people in that yeshiva from bar mitzvah age into their early 20s. Although the we know that Rav Zalman would go in 1897, we saw he'd go to Slutsk, but he was there in 1892. Although the students, these new students from Volozhin and other places, were now in the confines of a Musar yeshiva, the first Musar yeshiva, many of them still believe that they could act as if they're in Volozhin, simply just study Gemara and ignore everything else. Ignore the Alter's demands that they have to focus on their personality, on a Musar. It doesn't just come from learning Gemara. These students, that is, these opposing students, were actually encouraged by many leading rabbis, including the Rav of Kovno. The Rav of Kovno at this time was, his name was Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz. He was, in fact, hold on, I will tell you, his father was Yitzhak Elchanan Specter, the great Gadol. Yitzhak, so he dies in 1896. So by 1897, that's when everything really starts heating up. Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz becomes Rav within a year or two after. I'll tell you right now exactly. Hold on, just so we have the facts here. The exact year that Zvi Hirsch Rabinowitz, which I'll tell you in a minute why he was called Rabinowitz, because there's some confusion, I guess, about this. Hold on a second. I just want to tell you before we go on, because it's important for the story, why I forgot to mention this here, what year he becomes. I'm looking, if I can see quickly. Because he was Rav and he was in business, by the way, or Rabinowitz. And then later he comes, okay, I will, I can't, yeah, in 1896, he's appointed rabbi in Kovno, Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz. In fact, I don't know how many of you have been to Kovno, but you can go see his grave in Kovno. In fact, I believe I took a picture of it. I thought, if I'm confused here, I can show you the picture I took of. Yeah, I took a when I was there last summer, or 2 summers ago. Here, let me show you a picture of their grave right next to each other. Hold on, let me share it with you. It's just a grave of the two of them, Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz and Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Specter. Okay, so Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz, the Rav of Kovno, Kovno is right next to Sobotka, opponent of Musar, encouraging the students against it. Who else is an opponent of Musar? Ramosha Donashevsky. If you know Donashevskys, I assume they're all descended or related. Moshe Donashevsky, he's the Rav of Sobotka, also an opponent of Musar. In fact, they weren't just opponents of Musar, they were leading the assault on the organized study of Musar. And these rabbis, so their attitude was, we've already seen that this is creating a sect, some sort of phony elitist movement. They thought it was threatening the hegemony of Talmud in the curriculum. And by the way, in this they were correct, because the Musar students thought that the study of Musar was just as important as the study of Gemara. You don't devote as much time to it, but on the scale of things, it's just important. And they saw themselves as an elite group. And some people are good at Musar, others are good at Gemara. Now the students, the anti-Musar students, were also creating problems because they were writing to various rabbis, and they were also writing. They have letters in the newspaper on Amelitz asking for the Alter to being removed from his position, because he's interfering with their learning. No, it's the Alter's yeshiva, for heaven's sakes. This is like a hostile takeover. They want the Alter removed from his yeshiva. I want to read you something now from this book. This is by Shlomo Tykoshinsky. It's called Lamdanut Musar Ve'elitism, Yeshiva Sobotka Melita Eretz Yisrael. And it's a great book, all about the yeshiva, the ideology, the machlokes. On pages 338, 39, he speaks about the breakout of this whole dispute. And his argument here is that the rebellion is not like we're going to see in Tell's ideological, where it's the students oppose Musser and therefore he thinks the and therefore they rebel. He thinks in Musser, it's more about the fact that they're getting in your life, they're not giving you freedoms. They give more money to the Musser students. We know that. So that created lots of resentment. Now the altar had a reason. He wanted to encourage the Musser students. So the Musser students got more money. So that's his argument here. And so he thinks that the great dispute we're going to see now was more about lack of personal freedoms, the mashgiach, the altar getting in people's way, getting in their lives, bothering them, the unfairness they thought that the non-Musser students are being discriminated against in terms of funding. And remember that in Tells, the head of Tells is Rav Lazer Gordon. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. So fine, they have a Mashgiach there. But the Yeshiva itself is not identified with Musser the way Sobotka is when the head of it is himself a great Musser personality. So that's an interesting argument. I don't know if it's correct or not, but that's his argument. Well, it wasn't long in 1897. It wasn't long before a clear majority of the students were opposed not just to Musser, but to the altar of Sobotka, and they wanted him gone. And the yeshiva was split into two sections. And if you wonder how this could happen, yeshiva split into two sections. Well, it happens today, too. Today, the Ponovitch yeshiva split into two sections. We've seen it. We've seen it a number of times. And as I said, the anti-Musser students, they focus on the altar. They don't want to have to listen to a shmuzin. I mean, from their perspective, all of a sudden, they're in the middle of learning, and then he cops down, and everyone has to put away the gemaras, listen to the shmuzin. That, to them, is not important. In fact, it's reported that, and again, some of these kids were teenagers. You know, it's not like they have sports. It's not like they can do fun things. They're mischievous. That can explain some of this. So we know that Musser books were stolen from the yeshiva, were removed from the yeshiva. So when it's time to learn Musser, there's no more Musser books. That's a sort of prank that a young person would do. We know that when the mashgiach, when the altar stood in front to give his shmooze, a number of students started learning very loud. That is, not only did they weren't not just quiet, but they would start learning, hey, let's see us, you know, whatever they're saying. So you couldn't hear them, as a complete show of disrespect. By the way, I've shown you in the past, if you recall, I showed you a video from Ponovitch where one guy gets up to lead the Shemona Esrei and the other guy gets up and makes a big noise so he can't, because they're from different sections. In fact, it's reported that an actual fight broke out in the Beis Medrash in Sobotka. And you could see video of the fight that broke out in Ponovitch Beis Medrash. They actually threw chairs. I don't know if they threw chairs in Sobotka, but a real fight. Well, you weren't going to have any compromises here, because the altar of Sobotka, it's his yeshiva, and he's not going to accept any compromises when it comes to study of Musar. The only option would be to drive him out. But how are you going to drive him out? Now, from the side of the Musarniks, the anti-Musarniks are a bunch of scoundrels who, because they're trying to destroy yeshiva, because they're not given the money they want, because, you know, they came to this yeshiva, they knew what type of yeshiva it is. They come to a yeshiva. It's not like with Tells. Tells, they came to a regular yeshiva, which also has some Musar. So you could say, I guess maybe they had more of a justification for what they did. But here they came to this yeshiva. That was the altar's yeshiva. He started it, and they want to get rid of him. There's something wrong with that. And we don't know the role really of the maskilim. They were definitely encouraging the anti-Musser students, because they opposed the Musser leaders. They thought that the non-Musser people, they thought incorrectly, the non-Musser people would be more sympathetic. But we don't know exactly among the yeshiva students how many of them were influenced by them. But the maskilim would write about this dispute in the newspapers. The anti-Musserniks succeed in 1897. The controversy becomes so bitter that the yeshiva has to split. The way it's described by Katz in his book, Pumas of Musar, is as follows. Ratzvi Rabinowitz, the Rav of Kovno, invites Rav Yitzhak Blazer, a great Musar teacher at this time in Sobotka, and the altar, to a meeting with communal leaders. It's described in Katz on pages 98 to 99. And they want to have this big meeting. So they have a big asifa with community leaders, communal leaders from Kovno. And here is Rav Yitzchak Blazer and the Alter. And Rav Yitzchak Blazer, it's reported, sits there, listens to all their attacks, the terrible things they're saying about the Slabodka Yeshiva, canards, which are not true. And after listening to this, I don't know how long it went on, a half hour, an hour, whatever it is, he says to them, okay, good night. He gets up and walks out. Doesn't even attempt to defend the yeshiva's method, the yeshiva's approach. He saw no need to defend it because in his mind, there's no way they're going to accept this. And the same thing with the altar. He says that we were given this tradition of Musa. We're not going to move from it. Now, okay, so the yeshiva splits. What does this mean? One quarter of the students, there's about between 250 and 300 students, one quarter of them remained with the Musar side, so figure 60 or so. And the majority, three quarters of the 250 and 300 students, they remained the other side. So you think they would be kicked out? No, the Alter leaves the yeshiva and he opens up his new yeshiva. So what's going on here? Well, they didn't own the yeshiva. If it was his building, then he'd kick them out. He didn't. They were learning in what's called the Beis Medrash HaYashan. Obviously, it was a big Beis Medrash, but it belonged to the community. And so the fact is that the anti-Musar sides were the majority. So I assume the Alter thought it's time for us to leave. He takes his 60 or 70 Talmidim, and they go to a Beis Knesset called Halvayas HaMeis. You know, the people's job it was to deal with, the burial society. Every group has their own shul. And he sets up his own yeshiva over there. By the way, in 1900, they do get a building. And in 1934, they open another building, which was given to them by the city of Slabodka, which is the city of in Lithuania. And I looked for that when I was there. And look, I don't know. I had a guide who apparently she knows all this. And she said the building doesn't exist anymore of this yeshiva, his yeshiva. So I don't know if anyone made. And she actually, when Shneur Lyman did his tour, she was like the regular guide. But I have to ask Shneur Lyman, maybe the building does exist. But now, so one more thing. So who's in the yeshiva now? You have the Alter, but you also have Ramosha Mordechai Epstein. And he's the sole Rosh Yeshiva. So, and he wasn't involved in the Musar movement. He doesn't come from a Musar background. He's from Volozhin. There was some suspense. Where's he going to go? The Alter is taking his students, 60 or 70 students. They leave. The other students remain. Where's Ramosha Mordechai going to go? Ramosha Mordechai goes with the Alter. And very disappointing for the rebels. The Ramosha Mordechai goes with the Alter. So then they need the students who remain, the anti-Musar students, they need a Rosh Yeshiva. Well, the yeshiva for a time would then be run by Ritzvi Rabinowitz, the Rav of Kovno, and Ramosha Dashevsky, the Rav of Slabodka. This was the anti-Musar yeshiva. And the anti-Musar yeshiva chose a name, Knesset Beis Yitzchak. That's the name. Knesset Beis Yitzchak, named Yitzchak as Yitzchak's son inspector. Later, it would move to a place called Kamenitz, and was run by the Rosh Yeshiva was Reb Baruch Leibowitz. The Alter's original yeshiva, the one that actually had to break away, I mean, it's the original yeshiva, so which is the breakaway? Really, the Alter's yeshiva is the breakaway because they actually leave and break away, but they're the original yeshiva. They choose the name Knesset Yisrael, as in Yisrael Sonder. So from this point on, there are two yeshivas in Slabodka until later that one yeshiva moves after World War I sometime. It moves, or during World War I forget now, it moves to, sorry, ends up in Kamenetz. But if you're talking, let's say, the year 1905, and someone says they studied Slabodka Yeshiva, you have to ask them which Slabodka Yeshiva. You have to say which Slabodka Yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yitzchak or Knesset Yisrael. So now we have on the Musar Yeshiva, you'd think no anti-Musar forces in it. Just wait. Within 5 years, we're back to where we were. But before we get to that, now the Maskilim are jumping for joy. because you have the anti-Muslim yeshiva, and the Maskilim thought they can turn us into a yeshiva more inclined to Haskalah, because you got rid of these, extremists, people like Ritzav Blosser and the Altar of Sabotka. Now you can have a more modern yeshiva. But that never happened. In fact, in Kumos HaMusar, page 100, he quotes from an article that they wrote in Hameilitz. Now is the time, they say, to establish this yeshiva, now that the Musarniks are gone, that there can be Haskalah Ivrit, and they can get a secular education. And they really thought they could, but it was never going to happen. And the Rav Tzvi Rabinowitz and Moshe Donashevsky made it clear that this was going to remain a traditional yeshiva, no Haskalah at all. So Knesset Beit Yitzchak continues the Volozhin approach, and Knesset Yisrael, the Musar approach. Okay. So what was the altar able to accomplish then in Knesset Yisrael? Well, first of all, you have Torah learning at the highest level with Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. The idea that a Musar yeshiva wouldn't have Gemara learning at a high level is, of course, false. The altar, however, was able to really thrive in his Musar Shmuzim, which we know from the descriptions. We have many descriptions, were very influential. He integrated Talmudic logic, halachic issues, with his Musar, and he showed that the traditional focus of the yeshiva does not stand in opposition to Musar, that Musar helps the yeshiva. You know, we have descriptions of how the students would relate to the altar's shiur in his sichos. After the sicha, the students would come together and they'd debate it, just like they would do after the Rosh Hashiva's shiur. And this really was a fulfillment of the dream of the Yisrael Salanter, that you have a synthesis of Talmud study and Musar, and the two don't need to stand in contradiction. Now, there's another book, a valuable book. It's called Yeshiva Slita. Pirkei Zichronot, memoirs from all the different yeshivas, from different individuals. It's really great. And you have memoirs of the Tells yeshiva and the Machokas there. So what I'm going to read you now or summarize for you is from a Rav of Yerucham Bar Haftig. He's this father. There's a lot of Bar Haftigs in Israel. He's their forefather. Zorach Bar Haftig, who we spoke about, he was very involved in the rescue from getting people out of Lithuania. He was the son of Rav Yerucham. But in recalling the dispute at the Tells yeshiva, which we will deal with, he explains that, and the same thing applies to Sobotka, that you had these Musar students who would say, "You're great in Talmud study, but I'm great in Yira. Atem Giborim B'Torah V'Nachlu Giborim B'Yira." You know that. There's different ways of being a good yeshiva bachur in Sabaka. Not everyone could be the greatest lamdan, but then you could excel in other areas. So was the altar a gaon in learning? Or was he just a mashkiach who could inspire people? The tradition in the Musar, in the yeshiva is, and Kamenetsky, who does not adopt hagiography at all, he quotes his father as the altar was a lamdan, Lamdan Muvhak, and others say the same thing. However, I have to say that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who knew the altar as close as anyone during the time he was there, the early 20th century, in his famous, maybe famous because I made it famous, but his famous conversations, which in Yiddish with Yaakov Herzog, which you can listen to them on YouTube. And I can send anyone who reads Yiddish a transcript. But it's explosive stuff, some of the stuff in there. So, but in his transcript, in his conversation, he says as follows. He says that the altar is a tzaddik. Yaakov Herzog asks him, "Aber nicht kein Lamdin?" What is he? He's a Lamdin? And Rav Weinberg says, "Nicht kein größer Lamdin." He's not a great Lamdin. Eret gekannt learn, and he knew how to learn. Aber eres nicht gewein kein größer Lamdin. Aber eres gewein a chochem, a größer chochem. So here you have Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg saying that, he's a Lamdin. I mean, knows he's, but he's not Rosh Hashiva quality. That is, he couldn't give a shear to the high level. That's where you have Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. I understand this doesn't fit in to the yeshiva, history that says that the altar could have given you shearing, but he chose not to because he saw something on his day he thought was more important. A lot of people could give shearing, but who's going to teach Yira? Who's going to teach the things he's teaching about? Rabbi Weinberg says no, it's not true. Rav Yisrael Salanter could have. There's no doubt Rav Yisrael Salanter was a gaon in learning, in addition to that. But does every mashgiach need to be also be a gaon in learning? Rabbi Weinberg doesn't think so. And there are some other elements of Slavutka history. I'll just tell you this now, and I guess I'll get to next class. I'll explain why Tzvi Rabinowitz has a different name than his father. But let me tell you some other things about Slavutka, because in this interview, I mean, Rabbi Yitzchak of Weinberg is from the royalty of Slobodka. The Alter predicted he'd be the Gadol Hador. Never exactly worked out that way for maybe because of the personal issues that he had, but he was so close. And Rabbi Kamenetsky quotes, and he didn't have access to what I'm reading now, but he had access to personal letters to Dov Katz, which I also have access to subsequent to my book, which is why I didn't quote it, in which Rabbi Weinberg reveals such interesting things with him and the Alter. And he was a bit of a chutzpahdik also, Rabbi Weinberg, to the Alter, challenging him at certain times. But there's also something else which is worth mentioning in this discussions with Yaakov Herzog, which, because it's part of Slobodka history that was censored in Yateg Ne'eman. Yateg Ne'eman got a hold of before it was released. They got a hold of the tape, and they published the conversations, but in a censored form. So, for instance, this is what appears in Yateg Ne'eman. Rabbi Weinberg telling Herzog, I was intimately acquainted with Isaac Sher. Isaac Sher was the son-in-law of the Alter, becomes Rosh Yeshiva at Slobodka. His son-in-law, Mordechai Shulman, visited me in Berlin and wanted to hear shiurim from me. I told him, this is not your place. That is the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. Go back to Slobodka. Maybe someday you can become the son-in-law of Rabbi Isaac Sher. And that's actually what happened. He became the son-in-law. But that's not what Rabbi Weinberg reports to Herzog he actually said. It's in Yiddish, but I'll summarize it for you now. He tells Herzog that Rabbi Mordechai Shulman, Rabbi Mordechai Shulman becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka after Rabbi Sher. And there's a picture in one of the Art Scroll books. In fact, let me pull up here a picture of it, just so you see. All these rabbis would then, after the war, would come to visit Rabbi Weinberg. So I'm going to show you a picture here when I f from an Art Scroll book, actually. Here is in the 50s, early 60s, Rabbi Weinberg meeting with Rabbi Mordechai Shulman, who became Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva after Rabbi Sher. You know that among yeshivas, it's often the son-in-law who becomes who takes over, because the son sometimes isn't up to the task. The son-in-law, though, is always up to par because the father of the bride picks the son-in-law in those days. So you can be sure he's only going to pick a lamdan. The son could be a lamdan, maybe he's not a lamdan. At Remendel Zaks's funeral, the son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, Yaakov Kamenetsky, he had a very short eulogy, and he said that we know that he didn't only say this, but this is after a couple of psukim, whatever he did, Maamar Chazal. He said that we know that in Lithuania, the son-in-laws took over as Rosh Yeshiva often, and he says the reason for that is because what I just said, that the fathers would only pick the son-in-law if they knew they were a great lamdan. The fact that the Chofetz Chaim picked Remendel Zaks, that says enough, that you don't need to say any more about it. But what did Rabbi Weinberg actually tell Herzog? He says that Rabbi Shulman, in those days he wasn't Rabbi, Mordechai Shulman, he came to Berlin. Why? Not to hear shiurim from me, to enroll in the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. Now, Yateg Ne'eman doesn't want its readers to know about that, so it translates that Rabbi Shulman visited Rabbi Weinberg and wanted to hear shiurim from him. In the actual description, Rabbi Weinberg tells Herzog, Yaakov Herzog, that he tells Shulman, you'll never get a doctorate here. So why are you going to stay here? And even if you did get a doctorate, you're never going to get a rabbinic position in Germany. So go back to Slobodka. And then he adds, it could be when you return to Slobodka, you'll fall in love with the daughter of Rav Sher. He says, it could be when, or she'll fall in love with you. It could be when your turn. Gewiss sich verlieben, oder sie wird sich in dir verlieben. I know German, so I don't know how my Yiddish sounds. But what he's saying is they told Rav Shulman, go back to Sabatka. Maybe you'll fall in love with her, or she'll fall in love with you, and you'll become, it's funny. He says, it could be that you'll fall in love with her, or she'll fall in love with you. Wouldn't it be good if they both fall in love with each other? But I guess if she falls in love with you, at least you get the Rosh Hashiva, like maybe. I don't know, but that's what it says. And then he can become the son of Rosh Hashiva of Sabaka, and that's what happened. Of course, they omit this thing about falling in love. But that's what Rabbi Weinberg says, and that's part of the tradition. But I'll tell you something else now. That doesn't appear in any book, but it comes from a reliable source. When I say reliable, I mean as reliable as you can get in these matters. It's never appeared in print. And I don't know why the yeshiva world wouldn't like this story, because it answers a mystery. But the story is that Rabbi Huttner also had his eyes on the daughter of Rabbi Sher. And that when he didn't get that shidduch, he was devastated and he needed to get away from Sabatka. And that's why for a time, it was only a few months, he went to Berlin. He just had to get away and start anew. That's the story. That was known in the world of Sabatka, that story. You know, it won't be written, because first of all, the idea of, you know, wanting to a shidduch or something, I mean, it somehow doesn't fit with, I guess, yeshiva mentality, or the idea that then you'd be depressed and want to leave. But on the other hand, this actually answers a question. I would think in yeshiva, would they like this? Because it's always a big mystery. Why did Rav Huttner go to Berlin? Rav Huttner, he wants to study secular studies. He wants to go to Berlin. I mean, we can understand why Rabbi Weinberg goes to Berlin, why Rabbi Soloveitchik. For others, it's a big problem. Like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, why is he going to Berlin? I mean, so Rav Huttner, why is he going to Berlin? This answers it. You know, he was very upset. He didn't get the shidduch he wanted. Can't Rosh Yeshiva also want a shidduch? And therefore he goes to Berlin. So it's not that he goes to Berlin because Chas v'Shalom, he wants to study secular subjects. He needs to get out of the environment of Sabatka. So he goes to Berlin. But that's the story that was known in Sabatka. Rabbi Huttner wanted to marry her. And then, of course, he would have been the Rosh Yeshiva of Sabatka. And instead, Rabbi Shulman married her. Okay, so we're done for today. Next class, of course, we can, you know, all we've seen so far is the Musar, is Sabatka Yeshiva. But this then breaks out in the end of 1897. The entire rabbinic world is split. Pishkavilin opposite Pashkavilin. The greatest rabbis of the day come out with crazy, outrageous statements if you're a Musar person. And then the Musar rabbis come out with defenses of the Musar movement and crazy statements if you're an anti-Musar person. The Torah world was split. Split like it hadn't been since the days of the Hasidim. So over 100 years, 150 years, it was split. But it was a split that really took place just in the intellectual class. I don't think the average Jew, with all the stuff I'm going to quote from you, these took place in Hebrew journals and in newspapers. I don't think the average Jew had any clue as to what was going on in this ideological dispute that, again, as we've mentioned, really ends with a complete victory of even for Musar, even Knesset Beis Yitzchak, even Voloshin would later have a Musar Mashgiach. So what can you do? So let's pick up with some. Ruth says sushi is a lot of rice and smidge is something else. Okay, so what's the bracha on sushi? Rav Schechter holds the bracha according to the second tshuva, the bracha is mizonos, because it's only the rice. That's the second letter. Others hold that you actually make two brachas. You're supposed to make the bracha on the rice and then take the fish and eat the bracha on the fish. Well, if that's the case, then you are eating the sushi separately. Then the whole issue of bushel akum comes to the fore again. You're eating it raw. Again, I don't eat sushi, so I don't know what the general practice is. Based on what you say, Ruth, it would seem that you would make only mizonos because it's mostly rice. And I don't know. An important rabbi texts me that he makes mizonos on sushi. So rabbi I guess...
right, Rabbi Mark.
Yeah.
I hate sushi.
Yeah.
I don't eat it. To me,
It's a bunch of rice with something in the middle. And people eat, they don't take the fish out of it. I watch people eating.
Okay, but you're not, if you say you don't like it, you don't eat it, you can't be, me neither. We can't be part of the group that judges it. And what does it mean? I think Rav Schechter says, let's say if it's over 50%, if it's over, I think Rav Schechter says, or someone else says it, if it's over 50% of people who today will eat raw fish, then that would mean that it's not a, there's no bishalakum, but we don't like it. So it doesn't apply. We have to hear from sushi eaters what they think. If Jack says follow the money, people pay big money for the fish, not for the rice or the seaweed. So it's not secondary. That's a very good point. And there's a lot of people who won't eat sushi if it's just the sushi with the vegetables in it. They dafka want the fish. You're right, Ruth. It's Mr. Spock. What am I talking about? Now, Dr. Spock was a psychologist, right? Mr. Spock. You see, I'm not a Trekkie, so I didn't. Chaim says, and I thank Chaim, you're the one who's also sent me a number of the sources. You say, I think Rav Schechter's point is that the primacy of the sushi is the rice. Sushi would lose its identity without the rice, evident especially from the fact that the word itself means sour rice. Yeah, but if the way he describes it is, it doesn't have independent. He says no one eats it separately. So that's his point. You don't eat it separately. You only eat it together with the rice because very few people eat the sashimi. So in the first letter, he thinks it doesn't matter. But in the one that's published, the Daf HaKashrus, he says if they're eaten together, then you do not regard it as its own independent item. The other sources I read to you don't make that distinction at all. And he cites not here, but in the first letter, he cites a Darche Tshuva that would seem, as I recall, would seem to imply that. But hold on a second. He cites the Darche Tshuva is the father of the Munkacho. He's also is Rav in Munkach. Okay, I don't know what I do with my page, but I think he cites the Darche Tshuva that implies that, but there he rejects it. He says, like, if something's in sour, oh, here it is. Yeah, I found it. In the Darche Tshuva, Kuf Yud Gimel, he cites something that the Darche Tshuva speaks about something that gives it a little bit spice or something like that, but he says that here the vegetables don't change the tam of the dog. So in Rav Schechter's first letter, he says something different. So I don't know. I don't know really the source of this idea. Rav Belsi agrees with it, though. The other sources don't mention it, that just because you eat the raw fish together with rice, therefore the raw fish doesn't have independent entity. Even though people are only eating it, you can make the argument that I know they have the question about the wraps, what bracha you make on the wrap. But if you have a hamburger, granted, we assume that bread potters everything else. But when you have a hamburger with meat, you know, hamburger has meat. Are you going to say that the meat is really secondary to the hamburger? No, each are independent. We want the roll, but we also want the beef. It's a tough one. Jack says primacy is relative. Yes, you can make sour rice. Okay. You're married to a sushi lover. You know the distinguishing feature of sushi are the type and quality of the fish. So for a Schechter, that doesn't matter. He has this idea that if you eat it only together with something else, it's not independent, therefore it's not bishalakum. But for the other sources I gave you, it definitely matters. And it should be, it should change the bishalakum. Morris says, there's a well-known Yiddish expression about a young person who shows unusual wisdom is referred to as an alter kup. In other words, wise beyond his years. Yeah, yeah, we all know that expression. Yeah, thank you. How'd it go from Specter to Rabinowitz? I want to keep you here so you come back in 3 weeks. If you know Rabbi Rakefetz talks, he constantly repeats a story. But the evidence is not like the story he repeats, but I'll tell you where he got this story from, because he got it from a reliable source also. But what he says is not the story in the family. Dov says, oh, and you were in Slobodka, I think with Schneer Lyman. The old wooden Slobodka building is gone, but the new brick one still stands. You mean the one from the 1930? Okay, that one still stands, yeah. Ah, and I have to look in your article on Rav Ruderman. So when I asked for the Sobotka building, I was asking for the classic building. Paul says the best kosher sushi on the planet is Nama Sushi in Boca Raton. Not cheap, but otherworldly. Any royal table would love it. okay, that's... and Rabbi Shudno, who was stationed with the U.S. Navy for 3 years in Japan, chief rabbi of Japan, says, don't ask me about sushi. You were in Japan for 3 years. You know, Rabbi Shudno, I was only in Japan for a little over a week, and they never even offered me at the kosher places. They never even offered me sushi, which is good. So Paul says the fish is primary. Again, Paul, the fish is primary. But Rav Schechter is saying, as long as you eat it in his first letter, he would say then it's not bishalakum. But in the second letter, he says he can acknowledge the fish is primary, but he says you only eat the fish together with something. Well, I take that back. He doesn't say the fish is primary. I take that back because he says that you only make a mizonos. He says kasha liboa shadag hua ikar shibasushi. He says it's hard to say that the fish is the ikar in the sushi. Now all the sushi eaters I know say yes, the fish is the ikar, and the rice is separate, secondary. So here we have the same thing with Rabbi Tendler. Rav Schechter is the posek, but he's saying the fish is not secondary, but if the fish is secondary. But if every sushi eater you find says, no, the fish is primary, are we bound to Rav Schechter's psak? Because the Matzias is wrong. And he says that's why you make a mizonos. He doesn't even say you make two brachas. So it's a big machokas. It'd be curious to see in the coming years if we develop a certain binding psak or not. So I think Hadassah, maybe that's the building you're showing me, the Sobotka. That's not the classic building, that's the last building, thank you, which I didn't see. And finally, Rabbi Shudno says our local kosher supermarket has a kosher sushi section. Well, yeah, I mean, that's very common today. As I said, I was in San Antonio a couple weeks ago, and lo and behold, even in San Antonio, Texas, they have a kosher aisle, a nice kosher aisle there, they have a nice shul, and they have sushi. Because God forbid that the Jews be without their sushi today. I want to wish you all Chag Kasher V'Sameach and a Chag Sameach, depending if you're at the hotels or if you're at home. And I hope we come back in a few weeks and nothing crazy, nothing insane happens. And that's all. And we'll think about each other. And Rabbi Kalman.
Do you eat rice?
I eat rice. I love rice.
But not sushi. Okay. All right. I'm just curious. Sushi.
You know what? I've never even tried it. It's just not appealing to me. My wife likes it, but generally she just eats the vegetable ones because she says usually they're not so fresh. But at a good simcha with a good sushi, she goes for the fish also. And she doesn't think the rice is secondary. The fish is.
All right. I don't know. Okay. Anyways. All right.
Thank you, Jacob, for sending me this because there's a real stira in Rav Schechter's position here. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Sorry.
No problem. Okay. We'll see you. Please God here back in 3 weeks. And of course, we'll see everybody else hopefully this week, tomorrow, as I mentioned. Rabbi Shulman will be back in his, Tuesday slot talking on Pesach tomorrow, followed by a thing on the art history, the history of the Seder plate from an artistic point of view. So that's at 1 and 2:15 tomorrow. And then we have 1 p.m. on Wednesday and Thursday. And then my shiur on the Siddur this week will transfer to the Haggadah. And Menachem Ligdeg will be giving a shiur on Pesach on Sunday morning at 11:15. Okay, everybody. Be well. I'll call a second. That's all the crazy happens. Only good things. And that Hodul Hashem Ki Tov, that the miracles that we witnessed the other night should continue. And the Gula Shleima. To come. And Paul, I feel bad that you can't make it to Israel for Yom Tov, but hopefully you'll be okay in New York. All right. Anyways, slide the top, everybody. Be well. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.